Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. I am your host, Rob Cope, and today we are talking to British Florida-based pianist Simon Lasky about his brand new album, For the Dreamers. Before we start the interview, let's have a listen to a bit of the track Closer to the Sky. I'm going to play some of Tim Garland's soprano saxophone solo from this track because it is absolutely stunning and always so exciting to hear Tim. And checking out him playing on Simon's album has been a real pleasure. Simon Lasky, hello. Welcome to the Jazz Podcast, sir. How are you doing?
I'm great, Rob. Thank you for having me. I'm on hallowed turf. Very, very happy to be here. Thank you so much for all you do and for this and having me on, man. I'm excited.
I'm delighted to have you. And we were just saying before we pressed record, which I should have not pressed record. I should have done it sooner, that episode 252 in 7 years, which is great. The you know, if it's hallowed turf, it's only through my refusal to stop. But I did read this morning on the news, there's a BBC have commissioned a new jazz show called
It's Round. A momentous
did
day.
You see this?
I got off Facebook. Seb Scott wrote about it. Everyone shared it. It's really started the week off wonderfully. I'm so pleased.
In 7 years as a podcast, this is, I think, now I might be wrong, I think it's the first time there's been any new content funded or created at all on the BBC for jazz. Like, this is the very first time, and it's partly why I started the Jazz Podcast, because everything was taking a nosedive, you know, so for something to actually be like, it's like, seems amazing to me.
So Rob, you're almost like, your work is done.
Yeah. Thought that. I was like, wow, there's going to be funding for jazz again. But it was like a desperation to have a platform because there isn't one. So it's a start, isn't it? A very, very good start.
And Soweto is he's a smart guy. Wow, a brilliant musician, but he's such a smart guy. I follow him because he did have a weekly show, didn't he? It's weird. Radio is, you know, I was an NPR radio host out here for 3 years, and radio was one of the first things slated to basically die and finish as soon as the internet was invented. There was no need for radio. It won't have. You and I aren't on the radio right now, but it's, I don't know, radio is so valuable because you can do the dishes or drive your car or do Pilates whilst you're listening to it. And the same for podcasts. So audio is really important still, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think people underestimated how many cars there were when they announced the death of radio. It's like the only thing you can do without getting caught and pulled over.
Yeah.
So tell us about Florida, Simon, because the last time we spoke to you was probably about 6 years ago on the show, and you were still based in the UK, I think.
Yeah, London. Yeah. Me in Florida or Florida? Florida is a very unusual place. In some ways, and you know, it's weird now, you sort of drop your voice a little bit sometimes because it's got, well, don't want to get too into that, but you know, it's, I live in Florida, you know, there's a little bit of that because it's become quite a divisive place in some ways. I mean, you know, there's some great stuff happening here as well. I moved here in 2018 on the receipt of a fellowship to study jazz composition with Chuck Owen at the University of South Florida. And that's why I initially came here. It was an Chuck Owen is, I think for me, the best living, certainly top sort of two or three jazz big band composers in the world. His music isn't as well known as, he's up there with Maria Schneider, I'd say, and Vince Mendoza and some of those big names. And I met him at a conference in 2017. And not only is he a genius big band composer, he's a really nice guy. And I approached him and we kind of swapped CDs. And then I got back to the UK and it was kind of rainy November. And I was sort of struggling a bit with trying to figure out my next move. And I sent it, you know, he said he loved my CD. So, well, if I'm ever in Florida, can I have a lesson? And he said, well, funny, then he told me about this master's program and he heard my CD and he said, you know, he said it was very strong. And on the basis of that, he could offer me a fellowship to come and study with him. You know,
wow.
He was trying to recruit me.
Yeah.
And Rob, the fellowship was, and this is a while ago now, but it was, I was paid to come to back to school and get a master's and study with one of my heroes. It was a very big stipend. And I was his teaching assistant for the 2 years as well. And he's hugely regarded and well-known over here. So just sort of being under his coattails, under his wing, if I get my analogies correct, has been really beneficial to my career over here in the States. So that's the sort of medium-length answer of why I'm currently in Florida.
So you were very happy to stay once you'd finished studying and everything. What was that like?
Yeah,
that was a question. Sorry. Yeah,
no, it's a good question. It's the obvious next question. Yeah, so I had some quite major health problems. And so the 2 years turned into three, and then I graduated. And then we're in the middle of a pandemic, literally, summer 2020. And I had gigs here. Florida closed down for a little while. And then it opened up quite quickly. And some sort of practical reasons. So, you know, you could play outside.
Yeah.
There's lots of outside gigs and stuff. So, you know, and I'm talking to my friends back in the UK and they've, you know, they probably, like, as you remember, you know, you're looking at a diary with zero gigs. And so I had to decide. And so I applied for my artist visa. I remember you talking to Will Vinson about this years ago. So I'm on an artist visa now. I'm called an alien of extraordinary ability, which is, I always find quite funny because it's both very flattering and very offensive at the same time.
Yeah.
you know, like an alien of extraordinary, you're an alien, but you're amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're a good guy, a goodie.
Yeah. I had work in Florida and I had regular gigs and I could see a path of putting together the next record. And then I'm now on the faculty at the university where I was studying. So,
wow, that's so amazing.
It made sense to stay here, certainly in the short term. Yeah.
Right. What a great accolade to be able to go back to where it is that you were studying how did that come about to be on the teaching staff there? What was the name of the?
Yeah, so I teach at the University of South Florida, which is in Tampa, and I also teach at Hillsborough Community College, which I really like. Actually, I teach jazz piano there, and I teach some keyboard skills and theory classes and bits and pieces. It's what they call an adjunct professor. So I'm not full time. I'm grateful for it, and I like working with young people. And I've got, honestly, one of the two best things, I've got an office with a piano in, which I love, Rob. I mean, I've got a piano here in my apartment, but I love when I'm composing, going to somewhere, closing the door, turning the phone off, and feeling like I'm going to work. And I think I probably compose a bit more productively or practice more productively when I'm out of the apartment. And the other thing is they've got the resources of a jazz rehearsal hall, which is a faculty I can get into any time. And that's how I sort of started putting my octet together for the new recording. So, you know, like that's really beneficial. I love having somewhere where I can go and it feels like an office and you can structure your day around it. And I'm quite productive that way.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Being able to not spend a fortune in rehearsal room fees.
Absolutely, yeah. It's weird because I've got a gig at the 606 in London, an album launch coming out this summer, which I'm really excited about. But then your first thing is, cool, I've got, oh gosh, my music's quite hard. Where are we going to rehearse? And you know, typically Steve will let you rehearse there if you've got a gig there, which is great. But yeah, and then a lot of the faculty at USF are in the jazz faculty, are in my octet.
Right.
So, you know, they'll be on campus and we'll just, you know, they'll just finish taking a big band rehearsal, then we'll rehearse my music. And the latest album is very much a product of lots of versions of tunes, things that work, things that don't work, coming back a month later and then trying a different version. And so, yeah, it's a really cool resource. I'm very fortunate. Yeah.
So let's talk about the new album then. Tell us everything. All right. I tell you what, let's start this way.
Yeah.
How, at what point in the, because I don't know exactly how long ago did you conceive of this new album for the Dreamers?
For the Dreamers, yeah. I like making records. It'd been a long time, you know, a lot of life had happened. It's been 6 years. And I wanted to put an octet together, again, comprised of the sort of top jazz players here in Tampa Bay, and a lot of them are faculty at where I teach. And I wanted to, I don't know if you do this, I don't know if any of our colleagues do this. One thing I try and do with a writing project, and one thing I try and do what I'm not good at, maybe, because it forces me to get better at it. So I started writing for Big Band when I came out here, and I've been really enjoying that. And I feel like, so I used to play French horn. I'm getting to your question. So I used to play French horn, not very well, but I've written for orchestra, and I've always written pretty well for brass. And I've always written competently for saxophone, only because I never played it. And growing up, orchestra was my sort of large ensemble home. There was no jazz in my life when I was growing up. So I came to big band quite late, but saxophone, I mean, I can write for it, but I just wanted to get better at writing for it. So I've got an alto and a tenor in my octet. And I thought if I put a three horn thing together, it would really get my skills of intimately knowing just the registers a bit and how some of the intervals react with each other. So I really wanted a larger ensemble, and we've got strong sax players here in Tampa Bay. So I knew the next project was going to be for quite a large ensemble. Honestly, the way I write, Rob, it's really a mini big band. My charts are very through composed. It's, again, I think we all try and write to our strengths, and we try and, you know, do what we do well. And I come from a classical composing background, so my charts are quite long. For me, one of the biggest challenges, okay, this, I've got too much material. I've got to kind of reduce this down. So I wanted something kind of that I could make quite symphonic and quite sort of cinematic, and writing for strong local players. And that started, well, I remember calling the head of the jazz studies, and it was one of, I'm sure my listeners will relate to this. And I called him, and I thought, if I can get him on board, and, you know, that sort of unpaid rehearsals, and are you willing to play difficult original music? And he's a friend, Jack Wilkins, tenor sax, and James Suggs as well on trumpet. So I can get these two to agree to it. Then I can call everyone else and say, hey, I'm putting an octet together.
Yeah.
James and Jack are in it. And oh, I want to be in that. You know, it's that kind of thing. And they were very, very, I think all over the world, jazzers are really supportive of original music and original projects. I think we all love playing Straight Note Chaser, and that's kind of our bread and butter. But I mean, there's a colleague friend of mine, Ross Strauss, who's a young big band composer, who's got an amazing future ahead of him. And he has a big band out here, and I'm the piano player in that, and there's 13 charts, and it takes me, and they're all 10 pages long, and it takes me weeks to get it under my fingers. I'm not the world's greatest sight reader, but we all love doing it because we want to support original creative projects, because that's, I think, half of why we got into it, isn't it? So everyone's been very supportive. And then we started rehearsing, put some gigs in the book, and, you know, then the next thing is to make a record.
I love it. It's such a great idea to kind of start with the biggest fish, if you like, with getting people in the door, and then being like, oh, well, this guy's up for it. So, and then they all come like dominoes at that point. So how has your writing changed? Because it must feel like a world away from the last album.
Yeah, well, it's a great question, isn't it? It probably is, but it's also probably quite connected. I mean, I think And I made this point in the liner notes. I think I do like writing for the players I've got, and I don't have at the moment an upright bass player. I have an electric player who's actually Aldo Miola's bass player. Aldo Miola's rhythm section are actually based here in Tampa Bay for reasons I'm not quite sure, but he's a really strong player, and the drummer is kind of coming from a more, well, JT can kind of do anything, but you know, so rhythm section wise, there's only one of the charts on the new record swings, and we actually use a different drummer for that.
Right.
I mean, JT can swing great, but I got someone who's sort of, yeah, just sort of horses for courses a little bit. How's it changed? Man, I think it's really for others to answer that. I think it sounds like me still, but I think it's possibly a bit more confidence, and it's possibly a bit more individual. On the very first record, Rob, I sort of did that thing a little bit where we've got one that does that, so I've got to have one that's a bossa now. And there's a, you know, that first thing on the first record, there's a couple of tunes which, I mean, you shouldn't apologize for your music, but there's a couple of tunes that I'd probably, if they weren't on streaming, that would be fine. One of them's a bossa nova. It's fine. It's quite melodic and it does its thing. But I now don't see it that way at all. I just want to write very personal music that I think I do well. And
yeah,
you know, so it's more demonstrative than the previous albums. It's more confident. It's more brazen. It's weird. My playing's developed a lot in the recent years, but I actually had a thumb surgery 10 days before the recording. So there's not many piano solos on it, simply because I had to rescore it all because you've got eight players. It doesn't really matter. I just don't want the music to come across. But
yeah,
there's only one keyboard solo because I was kind of injured during last summer when we recorded it. But it's probably a bit more strident, brazen, confident. I don't know. I keep using those terms. I think it's better. I think studying with Chuck Owen was, you know, that thing when you go to school and during the time you're in school, you know, they call school, you know, university school, and I'm doing my master's, I'm learning anthropology and 12 keys and all that. It was pretty intense and it was challenging time. And then you come out and I've had, you know, 2 years of lessons with Chuck Owen, who is a brilliant teacher, a brilliant composer. I mean, Rob, just, I'll send you some of his stuff. His music is out of this world brilliant. I mean, he's got Grammy nominations and stuff. And then sort of year two, 3 years later, you realize some of the things he told you have sort of seeped in, but you didn't really realize. So I think...
That sounds ideal.
Yeah, I think I'm a better composer. I think it's more individual. Yeah, I'm excited about it. I'm thrilled with how it came out.
Oh, fantastic. So you said about coming back to London for an album launch. Tell us, how does that come about? How do you bring the band or do you book
UK gosh.
People? How is this going to... Well, can't even imagine.
Yeah, with a cover charge, I'd need to sell about 5,000 tickets to the 606, wouldn't I, to be able to bring the band? I did have a UK band before I left. We made two records, and we've always played at the 606. Steve Ruby's been very supportive, and so yeah, July 10th at the 606, and it's my core rhythm section. It's so. Sophie Alloway and Pete on drums and Pete Billington. And then, so Tim Garland's on the record on a guest track. I don't think he'll be there, but who knows? He would be wonderful if he was. And then Paul Booth on tenor, Sam Main on alto, and Shanti Jayasinghe on trumpet. And Alan Law was on guitar last time, actually. I'm not sure I'm going to use guitar this time. But yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, you'll be a better place to answer this. People know I'm over here in the States, so is there a perception, oh, he's in America, he must be doing great. I mean, that just because I'm here sort of thing, I don't, you know, so when I reached out to colleagues and friends to say, hey, I've got a date in London, they're pretty keen to play, and they're on the record as well, Rob. So Paul and Shanti and Sam and Tim Garland are on the record. The rhythm section isn't, but, you know, I wanted to keep connected with my UK audience because who knows when I'll come back, you know?
Yeah.
And you want to keep that connection, don't you?
Yeah, it's really special to have it, even not living here. to be able to, like, not just anyone can just like rock up, get a gig at the Six and play all their tunes. Like, that's really hard to do, even if you lived here. So to be achieving it over there is, it's really fantastic. It's brilliant.
Oh, thanks, man.
So what else have you got planned with the album? It's on Ubuntu, isn't it?
Yeah, it's with Martin Himmel on Ubuntu, and Martin's been great. And I know you're on there as well, which is awesome. It's really getting exciting, actually. We had one thing which will be coming out. It's been 6 years, and I've just, you know how much it takes to make a record. It's a big investment. Forget about the money. It's just a big undertaking. It takes a lot. Which is why when I was like an NPR jazz host over here, I'd always start with, like, if someone's sending me their CD to play on the radio, I'm like, well done, that's amazing. I mean, it takes so much.
Yeah.
You should feel immensely proud of this. Even if it wasn't my kind of thing or whatever, I mean, in jazz, not everything is everyone's kind of thing. It's fine. But now I'm enjoying this. You know, we've got two singles out already. And you start getting messages from friends and colleagues, and the reviews start coming in, it's a fun time, isn't it? Because all the work's done, and then, not all the work. So one thing we've got happening, which I'm really excited about, is I got a call back end of last year from this place down in Miami. It's called it's basically a sound and light stage, and they do all the big movies and productions and sound. You know, if Buble is playing in Miami, they do all his stuff. Anyway, they've got this sound stage in their studios, and they found my bass player knows is Venezuelan, and a lot. Miami's a very Spanish city. Anyway, this is kind of a long story here. I got a call if I wanted to bring the band down and record. Do you remember those Snarky Puppy videos where their audience sit in with headphones all around the band?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, they're like, it's silent, and everyone, it's like a disco vibe. Silent disco. Yeah. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. And the audience sit around the band. And so, Rob, I've got these videos coming out next month to support the release of the record. And it's my 8-piece down in Miami with the most extraordinary production values I've ever seen. Like, this thing is going to be as big as like NPR Tiny Desk, but sort of more Miami and more shiny and more glossy and less Radio 3 kind of thing,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
These videos would cost me, I don't know, 50 grand to make, 100 grand. And they just like my music, and they invited me down.
That's
them coming
incredible.
Out. Yeah, wow. I'm so excited about that. It's going to be beautiful because, you know, we're in such a visual time, aren't we? Younger people want visuals along with that. You know, you and I would happily put a CD on and listen to them, you know, with a glass of wine on our hi-fi and have a wonderful hour. But I think if you've got good visuals as well, that really helps. So that's coming out, and we've got album launches here in the UK, and I've got a radio promoter over here, I want it to I used to be a contemporary classical composer. That was kind of my composing career started in that way in my 20s, and you know, you play to 11 people, and now I just want it to I do want it to reach as many people as I want a big audience. And so, yeah, we'll try and make that happen.
That sounds incredible. I can't believe the opportunity that's there.
The Miami thing is mega. Yeah, I'm super excited. And there's also, you know, one of the other things is, I mean, Florida, bless Florida, because there's some really cool jazz societies which have got big support and big numbers. And I feel very, very fortunate to... So in a nutshell, basically, a lot of sort of retired New Yorkers retired folks from the north east of the country, they kind of winter down here, you know, snowbirds we call them. Right. When they come,
that's funny.
That's what they're called, and they want to keep their culture going when they're down here. So, Jazz Club of Sarasota, of St. Petersburg, of Tampa, there's a really good infrastructure in Florida, which I'm very grateful to be part of. which will put my octet on and will sell 200 tickets, and I'll be able to pay the band really well. And that's really amazing. I'm very blessed to have that. So there's a whole, a lot of them are supported by retired folks who love art, want to support art. They want their life to be culturally rich. So there's a lot of kind of volunteer organizations. And, you know, you'll probably maybe see on Facebook, I get after almost every concert, there's beautiful photos. And this is all like just by people who support me, my music, and other jazz artists in the area. So, you know, I can do a concert with my eight piece and not lose money, you know.
That doesn't even seem possible. It's not very easy to do that in London, I tell you.
No, or New York. Or New York. You know.
Oh, yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah, New York is really, I think people, it's just my opinion having talked to people there, but I think it's a lot harder than anyone ever possibly realizes, you know, just to get a gig.
I think it is.
So I was going to ask you about the crowdfunding, because I did it as a way of pre-selling albums and kind of growing the, like you, when you said about reaching new people with the music is what made me think of it and the videos. But I wanted to ask you how your experience of that was, and how is it like helped the project to grow? Because it's a tough choice for some artists, I think, whether to go down that path or not. But I'm very pro crowdfunding. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear that. Yeah, this is a sort of public service announcement. I've had so many folks, because I've done three albums via Kickstarter, and I will get to your question, but I'm actually about to, this week, a friend of mine called me. I've had lots of calls, like, how do you do it? Have you got tips? So we had a Zoom chat, much like this. I've recorded the whole thing, and I'm going to make it available to anyone who wants to just jazz crowdfunding. I'll put it on YouTube, and I'll send people a Dropbox link or something.
This sounds great. When will this come out?
Oh, sometime this week. Yeah, I'll send you a link, and I'll probably send it to London Jazz New. Anyone, because I think if you do it right, it can be very rewarding and beneficial.
Yeah.
And flip that round, I don't know how much you raise for your beautiful new record, Gemini. But I'm sure it's about 8-10 grand or maybe 5 grand. Or
it was really small. It was about 3,000, but that's all I needed. And I wanted to do it where everyone just paid £10 and bought an album, and then they got
amazing.
One. You know,
amazing. Really small. Amazing. Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, but you've been smart about it. That's kind of my point, is that if the Kickstarter people are listening, or if anyone's supporters, your jazz podcast supporters, Patreon supporters all over the world, these things don't exist unless there's resources. We're not having this chat today unless I did crowdfunding. I'm not independently wealthy. I'm independently poor, having been a student for like 3 years. I wanted to make a record. I don't want to call top jazz players and say, hi, can you do me a favor? I want to pay them properly, because I respect their skills and what they've done. And I want there to be, there's got to be money in the industry. There's got to be somewhere. You know, we know how difficult streaming is for us as small artists. There's got to be money coming into the business to keep the levels of playing and writing and production. And so, it's incredibly valuable. It's incredibly stressful. I don't know about you. If you did you do Kickstarter or GoFundMe?
I did an Indiegogo campaign, because you can do it as a flexible goal. So you just, as like selling albums, I sell as many as I can, but you don't have to raise a certain amount to get the money. You just get whatever you raise.
Yeah. So, so there's different kind of business models. I do Kickstarter, and the pressure of it is it's a miserable 30 days, Rob. It's miserable. You know, you'll set up a couple of friends or your mum, so you get a good start. And I've got a strategy, and like I say, I'm happy to share that with everyone. But then what tends to happen is, in the middle, because you've got to make your total after 30 days or you get nothing, and in the middle kind of couple of weeks, you're waking up, you got your cup of tea, you open up the laptop, and the figure hasn't moved for 3 days, and it's so depressing, and it's so like soul destroying. No one likes my music or me. I'm just gonna go work in Starbucks, or you know, and you sort of catastrophize what I do. But yes, I think if you do it right, and again, so that, let me connect the answer to the people I just told you about, retired New York folks who are down here, they've got disposable income, you know, they're successful people, they're the people who go to Blue Note and Birdland up in New York, and friends have got boats off the, you know, whatever. And I built up relationships with them. I was quite well known here because I was a local jazz host on the radio for 3 years. And so people knew me, and then people knew me hopefully as a piano player and band leader as well. And I wrote a list and of the people who, and it's quite an American thing. I think as Brits, we're not massively comfortable with it, but I emailed folks. I said, hey, you know, can you give me some money towards this? I mean, you're going to get something in return. And I think those little things like, you know, assigned seat. Again, this is really interesting, but by far the biggest reward that people chose was a signed CD or a thing in the liner notes. And if you don't make a physical product, what are you going to do? Like send someone his Spotify? By the way, you can't see your name, but you're sort of there. No, that's not as meaningful as...
It's not enough because they could listen to it anyway.
Yeah. It's not. So I think there is still an argument for physical products. And that was by far the most popular reward. And I had a couple of big supporters. We're talking four figures who put money in, you know.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. Been very fortunate. But Rob, I mean, you're very good at this. You're a very personable guy, and you know, you're smart because you're a wonderful musician and you've got that part of your career. But this jazz podcast for you did you see your review in Jazz Times? I'll send it to you. Have you not seen it yet?
I don't think so. What does it
say? Oh, man. Oh, it's great. It's here. It's here. Wait up. I can't believe you haven't seen this yet. I get my issue of Jazz Times here in...
Wow. Yes, I've been trying to buy one, but I don't know how to buy just one. Okay, this is amazing. Yes, I did see this. Yes.
And it starts with, Cope curates the jazz podcast and many of his values exhibited. So that was, but the point is you're smart because you've got this show which raises your profile worldwide and it helps raise your music worldwide as well, you know?
No, it works. The top countries for streaming my music are the same ones for the pod, you know. Wow. There's like, the top three for both is the UK, then the USA, then Japan. Yeah, it's really, the podcast, the jazz podcast has always been really big in Japan. Considering we're not Japanese, we don't speak Japanese and we don't have many Japanese guests. Yeah, you're right. But it was an accident. I didn't mean for this, but you're right. It is very accidentally beneficial. As a way of just staying present without having to release music every few months. You know, plus I just want to talk to people. This is so much fun.
That's a really good point. I think you've just said something really, because one of the things I don't know his name, the guy who heads up Spotify, you know, he did this announcement a couple of years ago. He said, you know, you just got to release more music all the time. And I think you and I know, and most of your listeners know for me, that's the opposite. I think I want to release outstanding music that I've worked on for years, and not everyone has to work on stuff for years. Maybe some people, I mean, Herbie and those guys always put records out once a year, but it's got to be to my creative timetable, not because I feel like my Spotify numbers are starting to come down because I haven't put anything out for 6 months, so therefore I better botch something together to fulfill. And if you're doing this bi-weekly, you're absolutely right. That's brilliant. It keeps you in people's minds. That's great, man.
Yes, keeping me sane. Because you're right. I feel that as well, that thing of like, you should do it as much as you can. And I completely agree. Like, I already have my next album planned for 2029. And I know roughly what it will be. Wow. But I need all this time to do nothing. So that it might be then lots of new ideas, lots of new influences, you know. I have to put that...
That's sort of like Gustavo Dudamel and Joe Lovano touring plans. Well, I can do something for you and get you in April 2029, but I'm booked until then. You know, that's sort of Christian McBride territory. That's amazing, man. Wow.
I know what it'll be called. I know what the band will be. I've got it all planned out. But I know if I do it any sooner than that, it won't be as good as it could be because there'll be too much left over from what I've just done, you know?
Wow, that's
too slow.
That's really, dude, that's, you know, we're in 2024 now.
I know. But I'm just not smart enough to do it any faster. I think it's got to be 5 years.
I love it.
Yeah. It's my plan. So, Simon, congratulations, sir, on this massive project and this incredible achievement, and the fact that from it has come more opportunities and you know, the cost of the album, making contemporary jazz albums, is sky high. But to have crowdfunded and then have these videos come into the mix and everything, it's brilliant. You deserve every bit of this success, and I'm delighted for you.
Oh man, that's super sweet of you. Thank you. Yeah.
So the album comes out on the 22nd of March. So for our listeners, we'll release this show pretty much in or around that day, and then everyone can listen to it and then enjoy the music.
Yeah. Amazing. Thank you so much for your support and for your kind words. I always felt we're all in this together. We've got to help each other. That's my kind of motto.
Oh yeah. Love it. Simon. Thank you, sir. We will be back in 2 weeks.